whether we believe that it is indeed general relativity. So talking about testing gravity, different, you know, from different ways we can test gravity, and also, you know, discussing some of the alternative theories that are out there. And there's still a bit damp underneath, so I'll talk a bit more. And so, to some extent, I mean, we've spent 3 weeks now getting to know general relativity in quite a lot of detail. We've used differential geometry and a lot of the techniques from differential geometry, and talked about various different interesting manifolds and the physical properties that they have. But how well do we actually know gravity, and have we been wasting our time? You know, is it really general relativity? And so that's really the theme of today's lecture. So it may seem like an odd thing to say, because actually, you know, I've been sort of persuading you that I've talked a lot about black holes, and this seems to be something that does describe objects in the universe around us. And if you go to the cosmology course, you'll see how general relativity is very successfully used in describing our universe. However, it's not like we're testing it to quite the same degree as we might when we test particle physics. So if we ask ourselves, what do we know? Well, going back, I mean, we know obviously a lot more now. Solar system tests, these are actually a lot of the reason why GR was first brought into as a theory. We've got perihelion precession, light bending around the sun, time delay. These were the classic experiments of earlier last century that made us believe in GR. But of course, these refer to a weak field limit. We usually perturb around a vacuum, test particles orbiting the sun, or geodesics in the gravitational field of the sun. And it's also at a particular scale. So let's say it's at the scale of order astronomical units. I mean, obviously, it's over a fair few orders of magnitude, but it's not like it's from the smallest scale to the largest scale. So moving up in scales, you might think that cosmology is a great test of GR. And it's true until you dig a little deeper. So for example, questions that arise. If we look at galactic scale gravity, we find question marks. We find that rotation curves of objects that are going around the center of our galaxy, the speed of objects going around orbiting the center of our galaxy doesn't seem to fall off as fast as we would expect, given the matter that we see. So this seems to indicate dark matter. Now, to some extent, we're not too worried about having dark matter, because if we also want to explain structure formation, we also need this extra secret ingredient. So while, to be fair, I should say that people have investigated looking at modified Newtonian dynamics to try and find a different way of explaining things like rotation curves, I think it's also fair to say that the majority of people, both in astronomy and cosmology, as well as in more formal gravity, would tend to say that they think dark matter is a more likely explanation that there is stuff in the universe that does not belong to the standard model, but nonetheless has properties of matter. It's essentially non-relativistic, so it has very low pressure compared to its rest mass energy. So yes, GR is sort of okay, but we're already having to add some extra stuff at galactic scale. Then we go to even bigger scales. So now we're really talking about genuinely cosmological scales. And it seems as if our universe is accelerating again. This is something that you'll see in cosmology. But in a nutshell, we can compare redshift of supernovae to their inferred distance from their luminosity, their brightness. Those supernovae are like sort of standard candles. We think we know how intrinsically bright they are. Therefore, when we see how bright they look, that gives us information about distance because you've got this sort of 1 over r squared fall off in intensity of light, crudely speaking. So in this case, this was about 20 years ago now, that two different projects looking at redshifts versus luminosity of supernovae noticed that they were dimmer than they expected. And the only way of explaining that in terms of an Einstein gravity universe was to say that the universe is accelerating. And if our universe is accelerating, that means you violate what's called a strong energy condition. So rho plus 3p is less than zero. So for example, lambda has rho equals lambda over 8 pi g is minus p. So cosmological constant has tension and not pressure. So again, we can explain this in the context of Einstein gravity, but we're having to introduce another unknown quantity. So just to put rough numbers on it, you know, here we're talking about 70% of the matter in the universe being this dark energy and about 25% dark matter. So these are just ballpark figures. So that's a heck of a lot of stuff that we can't describe using particle physics. So, and in particular, this lambda is ridiculously small from a gravitational perspective. So what it means is if we produce a cosmological constant, it has to be stable and, you know, to an incredibly, you know, precise level. And so it cannot get any sort of extra corrections from, you know, when you're looking at your particle theory. So these are questions. I mean, it's not that we can't explain cosmology. Cosmology fits very nicely within the framework of general relativity, but it also has these little niggles. Then finally, as you will see, going to the early universe, there's something that we call inflation, which is a period of very rapid expansion near the start of the universe that kind of makes it sort of very flat and very homogeneous, which is what we do see around us. And the paradigm of inflation does work very well. However, it lacks a concrete model. So we can explain the world, our gravitating world around us, but it also throws questions back at us. What is dark matter? What is dark energy? And what happened in the early universe? How are we going to get this description, which works incredibly well, of a quantum field theory on a sort of semi-classical background? Works incredibly well, but no concrete model. So that's taking us from the solar system up to the largest scale we know, the universe. What about going down in scales? Well, we can certainly, gravity in terms of a planetary scale was well tested. I mean, we got us to the moon and back. And even people have tested equivalence principle and gravity at sort of tabletop scales. But sort of gravity below below a millimeter, but something of that order anyway, sort of fractions of a millimeter, is not actually tested. Now, that's sort of unsurprising because it's such a weak force. So how would we test it at these scales? The other thing is that although cosmology is testing our manifold structure as a whole, we input some assumptions about the manifold to get our metric, to get our Einstein equations. It's not really testing extremes of space-time, so things like black holes. So this would also be what we call strong gravity. Regimes in which curvature is very strong. So I'm thinking here about near a horizon of a black hole. You could say very early universe, but I don't think that we're really yet at the point of picking that apart. So that still means that provided we could construct some alternative to GR, that nonetheless, in the weak field limit looks the same, or from the perspective of cosmology looks the same, then how do we know that we haven't got something other than GR? So this is a very active field. Known as modified gravity. So we've actually already seen an example, in a sense, of modified gravity when we looked at Kaluza-Klein theory and reduced our five-dimensional gravity down to four dimensions. So let's just have a closer look at that particular theory, point out some issues with it, and see if they're fixable. If I'm talking about scalar tensor theory, I really ought to mention Jordan, Brands, and Dickey, who in the sort of 50s, 60s-ish, first explored this general idea. So although Kaluza and Klein had produced what we recognize as a scalar tensor theory, at the time, they just fixed the size of the internal dimension so that they got exactly Einstein gravity. So they weren't really looking at this as providing a new gravitational theory, because that wasn't their aim. Their aim was to unify gravity and electromagnetism, so they didn't want that extra scalar field. However, later on, I think people were trying now to think more generally about gravity. And one of the puzzles was essentially how did Newton's constant come to be in the first place? So what defines an inertial frame? If you spin a bucket of water in space, how does it know to feel some sort of centrifugal force and have the water sort of curve and go towards the outside of the bucket? What's defining the rest frame in empty space? So this is something that is sort of, I guess, philosophers had a go at, which was called Mach's principle, which was the notion that all the rest of the matter in the universe defines the rest frame. And also that somehow the presence of the rest of matter ought to somehow also tell you about inertia or acceleration, and therefore about gravitational acceleration, and therefore about G. Now, it didn't really quite work, this idea, but that was where they were coming from. The notion was that you replace Newton's constant instead by some field, and then somehow all the rest of the matter of the universe defines for you what your mean value of that field is. So it defines Newton's constant for you. That was the sort of motivation anyway. So their action You can see how this is similar to the Kaluza-Klein in the sense that if you replace phi by e to the I chi, then you've got that exponential prefactor, conformal factor in front of R, and it sort of gets rid, partly at least, of exponentials in the kinetic terms. So these give modified gravitational equations. So you start off with something that looks like Einstein, but instead of Newton's constant, you've got 1 over phi. But then, as we know from our additional pieces, the delta RAB, we get also derivatives of phi. Something that looks like Einstein gravity, but now with a varying Newton's constant and some extra energy momentum from our scalar field. And then our scalar equation plus the trace of Einstein. Tells us that our scalar field couples to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So matter will generate some non-trivial profile of phi. However, it doesn't take much to see that if phi is varying on sort of scales like the solar system or even the galaxy, that would completely wreck our standard GR. So solar system gives us a very strong constraint that tells us that this coupling constant has to be absolutely tiny. So in this format, this doesn't work. Although when it was being put forward, there were, you know, the precision of experiments was much lower, so it wasn't quite such a dud thing to do. But again, it's a very simplistic model. It's just got a kinetic term. What happens if we add a potential? So I'm just writing this using the notation that's usually used. So I've done a conformal transformation. This little phi is basically a log of the big phi. And here I've got my conformal factor. When we talked about Kaluza-Klein reduction and transforming things to the Einstein frame, we were just looking at the gravitational sector. So we didn't really think about what that meant as far as matter was concerned. But in this case, if we have now, in addition to our gravity, scalar tensor gravity, we have some matter fields, which is what psi is meant to just represent in some generic way, then those will couple to the metric in this non-Einstein frame, what we call the Jordan frame. So when we do our conformal transformation, it means that unusual couplings show up. So we get couplings between the kinetic terms of our matter fields and our gravitational scalar field. We call this non-minimal coupling to our metric because it isn't just a standard kinetic term. We've got these A of phis floating around. So our phi equation of motion here you saw that the wave operator of phi with no potential coupled to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So here you see that you've still got this same sort of structure. Rho is just telling you about the trace of energy momentum tensor, but of course we've got a dv d phi. So we can define an effective potential, which is V effective, which is V plus A minus 1 times rho. So we have an effective potential, which now takes into account the fact that our scalar field has some self-interaction via phi, but also that it's coupling to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. Now, before, it was that coupling of the scalar to the trace of the energy momentum tensor that was kind of a bit worrying, because it was saying that in dense regions, our scalar would be affected. But here, if we take our bare potential, V, to be something that kind of decays now as phi gets large, then that means that the two terms kind of compete. So if this is our V effective, if I were to sketch my V, this might be a V, and my A row, then my actual effective potential is now something that is nicely localized. And if rho is very big, it's actually got a very sharp minimum. In other words, the mass of our scalar field around the minimum is high. So this is now something a little different, because why would you want a rolling potential? Well, at very large scales, if you had very little matter, a rolling potential is something that gives you something like dark energy. The problem with an extra rolling scalar giving you dark late time acceleration was that it gave you extra forces. You have a scalar floating around that interacts with matter and destroys Einstein gravity in the solar system. However, if our scalar is something like a conformal factor, maybe this type of process can just, you know, localize it and also make our scalar massive. So this process of kind of freezing out a scalar like that is called screening. And it's really completely analogous, actually, to sort of screening in superconductivity. The idea is you're making something massive in a particular region, and therefore it freezes it out, and you don't see the interactions of the scalar. If rho is lower, the small rho, a small rho, you have a much smaller mass of the scalar, and so you essentially have this fact that the scalar is now allowed to roll. So you can see that here the minimum has moved, and so if this were like a galactic environment, our scalar might be frozen, but at very large scales, I mean, maybe the minimum's pushed all the way over here, you can see that the scalar field at least has the potential of being able to roll and thereby produce acceleration. So that's just an idea, one sort of possible set of ideas that people have had to modify gravity, but only at large scales, kind of fitting the story that we have from solar system physics and also from cosmology. So what could we do to check this or test it? So how do we check our ideas at the very large scale? Well, we look at things like our expansion history of the universe. So using supernovae, or mainly supernovae at the moment, that allows us to sort of track back what our redshift, what our recent expansion of the universe is, which gives us information about Einstein's equations recently. So from our perspective, we would say this was recent geometry. And in the sense of something like this modified gravity, if we've got a Lagrangian theory, we can just go and calculate what it does and we can check it against what we see. There's also structure, formation of structure. So people do simulations of how structure forms, given sort of some slight perturbations in the universe. How do these cause accretion and then cause matter to clump and then in turn form structure like galaxies? Again, that is a sense in which one can pick apart the gravitational equations coming from these types of theories and run them through a supercomputer to see what we get. Is it significantly different from what we see or not? So that's something else that people do. There's also the microwave background. You'll be sure hearing a lot more about that. But the microwave background starts testing now somewhat earlier features of the universe. So once again, you can test the sort of type of fluctuation spectrum that we believe might come out of something like inflation. And then we look at how that propagates forward to the time at which the microwave background is formed. And we can do that again within the context of this, one of these gravitational theories. So there's essentially, I think the main effort at the moment is going into looking at how do we test specific features of a potentially modified gravitational Lagrangian? Which of those features contribute to changing things to do with formation of structure or changing things that happen with the microwave background? The recent geometry is perhaps less of an issue, but again, looking more carefully into surveys of structure, perhaps gives us, you know, again, more of a clue, because the better we know the structure around us, the better that we can compare to outputs of some numerical simulations. So these are the sorts of things that people are doing to test these modified gravity theories, at least at the cosmological level. But there's also other things that we could think about to test this screen scalar approach. So other things people have been doing are looking at stellar main sequence stars. If you have these scalar forces around, now while they may nicely freeze out in a weak field limit, if you've got a slightly sort of more dense or hotter environment, higher energy environment, these scalar forces will be there. And so energy will be dumped into a scalar sector rather than just purely into gravity and the matter. So that's another check that people can do. An obvious one is black holes. More on that in a minute. So black holes, clearly we're now sort of feeling like we're really getting to know these creatures. We've seen a merger of a black hole. So, you know, somehow if we've got extra fields floating around and energy can be dumped into the extra field, surely we might see some relic of that. Finally, I just wanted to very briefly mention another idea that people have had to check these. It's actually called atom interferometry. So some of you know going to these various quantum courses, but roughly or essentially people are getting really, really good now at exploring quantum mechanics over macroscopic scales. So that means macroscopic in this, compared to an atomic scale. So we're talking about meters versus nanometers. And if you're really clever, once you start probing, you've got states that are inherently quantum states. So, you know, they're not, you know, we haven't observed them. They're pure, not pure, shouldn't use that word. They're quantum states, but we're now able to manipulate them over macroscopic scales. So that now raises the possibility of exploring aspects of gravity at those scales. And in particular, if you can generate a pure vacuum in which there's no rho, then that should give you some effect from one of these scalars, which potentially you can pick up from one of these experiments. So that was suggested by some theorists a while back, and I think they've actually, someone's actually tried to do the experiment. So that's another kind of, it's a very different way of bringing the quantum into gravity. This is absolutely not quantum gravity. It's including gravitational effects into quantum mechanics. So let me just say a little bit more about black holes. Because there's sort of aspects when, if we have scalars around, there's kind of a little bit of confusion in the community, or a little bit of lack of clarity about how scalars and black holes kind of interact or get on. So black holes obey what we call no-hair theorems. And what this means is that there are only long-range charges of a mass, electric charge, magnetic charge, and angular momentum, which is a very small amount of information. So if we were to have a scalar, let's say it's light so that it doesn't couple enough to perturb a black hole background much, then if the scalar were to, if a black hole had scalar charge, then there would be a solution to that equation because there would be some profile of the scalar outside the black hole. Now, phi tends to zero as r tends to infinity for finite energy. And then if you look at this equation as r tends to 2gm, you can see that phi also tends to zero as r tends to 2gm. So in other words, phi is pinned at zero at both the horizon and infinity, which means it has to have a turning point in between, but at a turning point, our phi double primed is going to equal m squared phi over 1 minus 2gm on r, which would be positive if phi were positive. And of course, a maximum should have negative phi double primed. So that's a contradiction unless phi is identically zero, i.e. no charge. So that's the sort of essence of the no hair theorems. They get more involved as you want to be, say, include gravitational back reaction and allow for more general potentials. But this encapsulates the essence of no hair. It's basically that your wave equations do not allow for non-trivial profiles around the scalar field, or most wave equations don't. However, this sort of tends to, or at least there was a tendency until very recently, for, and in fact in some people still, for this to be taken to mean that there are no non-trivial profiles, matter profiles, field profiles around a black hole. And that's just not true. All you need is, for example, this particular assumption was that it was static. Sometimes you just need time dependence. And if you have one of these screen scalars, you no longer have a simple m squared phi. You've got other terms involving the local matter density. So we have the fact it's static, sometimes breaking that works. For the screen scalars, well, the screen scalars respond to matter. So if we have local matter like an accretion disk, and actually an awful lot of black holes do have a lot of matter in their local environment, then this also induces a scalar profile. So if we have these screen scalars or other scalars, it's far from clear that the local horizon environment of a black hole is indeed just going to be completely blank from on the scalar slate. So how might you test some of this? Well, being a PI, I'm sure you've heard about this thing, the Event Horizon Telescope. Proposes to image the black hole. Now, of course, it can't really directly see the black hole. What this means is that they're looking at light that escapes from this really strong gravity environment around the event horizon. So let's just take a look at, you know, why, you know, what sort of the flavor of the type of things that they have to grapple with. So as always, we're going to make it a lot simpler. So let's look at photon trajectories in Schwarzschild. So we're going back, I think, possibly not quite the first week, but where we had our effective potential approach to finding GD6. So that's our potential for our geodesic, our null geodesic. And then let's just take R to be very close to 2GM. And an initial condition of R dot is zero. So this is, we're imagining that we have a light ray that's kind of grazing our black hole. And we're taking it at the moment that it starts to climb out of the gravitational potential. So our geodesic equation at this initial point gives us a relation for H. So we have a very high angular momentum for this this geodesic at the moment that we start looking at it. So our phi dot is big. So what does that mean? That means it's got a huge angular velocity, and so whereas it's just beginning to climb out of the gravitational potential, so R is not going to change very fast, whereas phi is huge, is big, it's 1 over root epsilon. So what it means is our light hugs the black hole event horizon and goes round several times before it escapes. This is our black hole and our geodesic. We may have something like that. So I kind of encourage you actually to do a little Mathematica or whatever workbook and just solve the equatorial geodesic equations for photons and just see this sort of what we call a strong lensing effect. So obviously images get very distorted. And the other feature is that multiple orbits and the fact that multiple orbits mean our geodesics stay in the vicinity of the black hole in this very strong gravity regime for a significant amount of time. So again, I encourage you to Google and have a look at some of the numerical simulations that the strong gravity guys do to look at images coming from either black holes or neutron stars. Because this photon's going right round the black hole, what's happening is you're basically able to see round the back of your black hole. And neutron stars are a bit bigger, so you don't get quite the same effect, but they're still very close to a Schwarzschild radius. So even with a neutron star, you're often seeing a significant way around the back of it. And so it's kind of fun just how much distortion this strong gravity regime actually gives you. And so if you modify your near horizon regime from Einstein gravity, it's going to show up in some of this imaging. So again, some of the effort in terms of, you know, trying to interpret what this event horizon telescope sees, a little bit of that effort has gone into exploring what if that local horizon environment is not quite Einstein gravity, what would you see? It's not as simple, obviously, as formulae on a board, because here, you know, I'm doing an exact geodesic and assuming I might have an exact image. And of course, that's far from the case. They're really having to work hard just to get any degree of resolution at all. So they have to kind of translate this sort of idealized stuff into what actually gets seen. But I mean, you know, that I think is something that's very promising, because it's something where we can actually look at the local environment in some detail. And of course, our black hole mergers are another way that we are testing very strong gravity near horizon, and in fact, very dramatic processes when two horizons merge. So some people, you know, in the sense of with black hole mergers, what needs to be done there, and this is and this is quite a big ask, is that we need to actually start saying, well, if we don't quite have GR, what would happen to our signal? So and I say it's a big ask because it's one heck of a numerical calculation. So people have actually looked at black hole mergers in scalar tensor theory, but you know there are so many different flavors of scalar tensor theory. What you don't want to be doing is to be rerunning a very expensive simulation each time. So I think now that we've seen a gravitational wave signal, probably the sort of boffins, if you like, we're going to have to go in and start trying to categorize what generic features of modifying gravity, you know, do we get, and how do these generic things feed into templates? So I think the note of caution here is, of course, that the signal-to-noise ratio is not great. It was wonderful for the first detection, but typically, a lot of the times, they're picking the signal out by using templates. So that's kind of a note of caution here. So we do need templates for alternate theories. And ideally, I think, rather than doing it for specific theories, trying to sort of have a general way of parameterizing modified gravity. So just a final word, it's something that I've mentioned, but I just want to sort of end with just some thoughts on where we're headed in terms of quantum gravity. So this is an issue that's actually been with us now for, nearly 40 years. About 40 years. That's a long time. And the gist is, when we form a black hole, we form it from collapsing matter. So what that means to the past, we have perturbed Minkowski. And to the future, we have Schwarzschild. So here I'm sketching a Penrose diagram for a black hole that forms from gravitational collapse. So in this case, we have a future event horizon only. So this is what we really think a black hole looks like, not that sort of lovely symmetric Schwarzschild Penrose diagram that I drew, which was maximally extended. Everything that goes behind the horizon is lost. But of course, I argued that black holes had a temperature of 1 over 8 pi gm in our suitable C equals H bar equals K equals 1 units. So it loses energy at a rate which goes like T to the fourth times the area . So in other words, it looks like 1 over m squared. So m dot is proportional to 1 over m squared. So our black hole fully evaporates at a time scale that's inversely proportional to the mass cubed. So why is that an issue? Well, we could set up our formation of a black hole to be formed from a collapsing quantum scalar field, some pure state, say. So whereas our evaporating black hole . If again I now ask, what does it look like? As t goes to minus infinity, I have Minkowski perturbed. I form an event horizon, but my black hole is evaporating and eventually disappears. So as t goes to plus infinity, once again, I have Minkowski spacetime. However, if I kind of look at draw a space-like surface there, this thing up here would be some Cauchy surface. So in other words, it determines its whole future evolution. And down here, it should be. But in terms of what's happened, we've actually lost, between here and here, we've lost all the information that went behind this event horizon. So we've got an internal boundary to our space that's transitory because it disappears at some particular time. And so if we ask for what happens if we're sort of taking a basis for our scalar wave functions, a basis for past infinity is still not going to be quite the same as the basis for future infinity. And so what we have is a loss of information, or as more commonly said, a loss of unitarity. So our final state is not fully determined by the initial state. We have this instantaneous naked singularity, which gives us a sort of loss of prediction. Or, you know, the radiation is a pure thermal state, but we could have set our black hole up from something very special. So there's definitely something from a quantum perspective that's not quite right there. So this was obviously realized very soon, and various different fixes were proposed. Perhaps the black hole left a remnant. Maybe as it's evaporating, it somehow leaks information about what formed it. There's still no resolution of this. To some extent, I think it probably relies on the fact that we're sort of still using our classical gravity and yet our quantum field theory. But there's been some interesting recent papers from Hawking, Perry, and Strominger, who are now analyzing carefully the sort of way in which you can encode information on these null infinities. And they're a bit of a ways off being able to show it, but they're kind of arguing that by looking at the future null infinity, you can have little imprints of information over what has happened in the past in the space-time. So that's kind of interesting. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. But, you know, I think that's another sort of, on a theoretical end, this is another area in which maybe something exciting might happen soon. So gravitational waves, event horizon telescope, and black hole information problem. Watch those spaces in the next few years. Okay, time to stop.